It's okay. Okay, we have just a little bit left of the previous sugya before we move on. So we're talking a lot about Asiyas Gag and Mechitza, and we quoted about whether the Gag alone is a problem, whether the Mechitza alone is a problem, or the combination of the two is a problem. One last comment that the Mishnah Berurah makes in this sugya, which is somewhat questionable. Mishnah Berurah says that we spoke a lot about the possibility of putting up a mechitza. The person is putting it up only as a mechitza samroi. So unless it's being done with tzorach to be mat or something, so everybody agrees that it's mat. Rashi holds, even if it's being put up to be mat or something, it's okay. But even the way we pass like Rabbein Atam, that mechitza materas is a problem. But if it's not being put up to be mat or anything, then for sure it's going to be okay. So Mishnah Berurah says, based on this, there shouldn't be anything wrong with hanging a sadin, hanging like a carpet or something, hanging a sheet or something on a wall. If all you're doing it is just for the purpose of make something pretty, you just want to hang up some kind of a decoration or something. So obviously he's not talking about nailing in a decoration, but just hanging something, it's already hooked there, there's already a nail there. So just to hang something on the wall doesn't seem to be a much of a problem, because what is it? It's not a gag. At worst, you want to call it a mechitza, but it's mechitza she'en materas. Mechitza she'en materas should be mutter according to all opinions. So the simple meaning of the Mishnah Berurah is that you can hang a picture on Shabbos. Now you can't make a nail, can't knock a nail into the wall. The Gemara says that if you make a hole in a structure, that's malacha d'oraisa, that's part of the malacha of bona, because you're improving the structure, you're adding something or detracting something from the structure of the wall, making it more functional to hang things. So that's a problem. But if the hole is already there, the nail's ready inside, you want to just hang something onto the nail, that sounds like the Mishnah Berurah, that should be okay. Or to remove something from the nail, sounds like that should be okay. It's not a Sias oil, it's not a Sias Bechit, it's mamish nothing. So the Chazanish disagrees with that Mishnah Berurah. The Chazanish writes, he thinks that, not only is it not mutter, he thinks it may be Shavu Deraisa, thinks that when you hang something onto the wall, if you're planning on leaving it there for a significant amount of time, so even though it's not literally nailed in, but that's called a Kavua. That's called a Mosev Labinyan Kavua. Everything we've been talking about for the last 2 weeks has been assuming that it's all aroi. But if it's kavua, if it's there to stay for a long period of time, that's considered to be a shal of binyan deraisa. So Chazanish says that just to hang up a painting on the wall, hang a picture on the wall, hang a sheet on the wall as a decoration or something, if it's being put there for a long period of time, that would be also, or similarly to remove it would also be also, that would be an issur of soser. And I told over the story when we were learning the Malach of Tzod. Now this came up for us Lamaisa. We once had this, lived back in the Heights, we had this big, like almost like a hornet, which came flying into the house. And it was a Friday night, we were babies in the house, we were trying to figure out how to get rid of this thing, and it flew behind one of the pictures on the wall. So the Shiloh was, should we try to remove the picture off the wall and try to go after this thing? So it flew behind the picture. We still have the picture in the house now. It flew behind the picture of the Rosh Yeshiva, of Rav Govich Zatzal, Rosh Yeshiva Kibbutz Yavne. So I remember at the time saying that, you know, Rav Govich was a Talmud of the Chazon Ish. He was very close with the Chazon Ish, and you know, the Chazon Ish held that to remove the pictures off the wall, the Shal of Sosa Deraisa, and then the Chazon Ish also held the Shal of Tulta Mukta, because anything that's Kavua Bimkomo is another problem, even though there's no malach involved, it's not a klish malach or anything, just the fact that something is set in place for a long period of time, that in of itself may be a problem of Tulta Mukta. So I said, I don't know if that's the right picture to move things under, so we'll go figure it. Yeah, the Shmaya, the hornet listened to Meshtel Torah, and it flew away, and it flew under, we had a picture of Rav Moshe. So who Rav Moshe? That's a whole different story, I said. I said, Rav Moshe held that you're allowed to maneuver the pictures, because Rav Moshe held that it wasn't really a problem of Mukta. I don't know what Rav Moshe held about the Sosa Bona Shal. But anyway, as this whole Shtukh was going on, I think my wife was ready to go after me instead of going after the hornet at the time. But Tachlis, this thing flew away, and it fell right on top of the halogen light. And it literally was barbecued itself. Mama started to smoke. But the problem was that we thought the whole thing was going to blow up in a flame. So I had to go unplug the light on Friday night. So I remember I yanked the plug out. If it would have been a split second, every second would have counted. I would have done it in a normal way also. But I saw I probably had a couple of seconds to play with, so I patched it around and pulled the thing out, Kiliachayat. So thus, the Malacha Soser Boner Paskin and the Sobolovsky home based on such a sister return. Anyway, that's pretty much the end of the last sugya in terms of Sias Gag and Sias Mechitza.
Kids putting blankets over a building.
Oh, very good, excellent. So, the Chorah, That should be like the Gemara says Beitz about piling up the barrels, where it's not really being done to protect themselves in any real shape or form. But if you do both the Mechitza and the Gag in that order, it's a problem. So I tell people that they should try to, when they have to help the kids make these structures, they should, someone should hold the top first, and then someone else should slide the thing under, like the Gemara says Beitz about the barrels, I think is the more correct way to do it. Okay, so ready to start a new sugya, continuing the Malacha of Bona. And now we move into the realm of Binyan B'Kalim. Does the Malacha Bona make any sense when we're dealing with utensils? So up until now, we've been dealing with Bona in terms of roofs and walls and structures and things that are connected to the ground, quasi-connected to the ground. And not a great surprise, because that's where Malacha's Bona was in the Mishkan. Bona in the Mishkan was the building of the Mishkan, the building of the crusher, the putting together the structure. So what is the Halacha about Bona on something which is not really a structure, something which is a kli, which is a utensil? Is it subject to the Malacha of Bona altogether? So the Gemara does have a phrase in Maseches Beitza that ain binyan b'kelim, ain stira b'kelim. Actually, it's a machlokes in the Gemara, but it seems to be, at least according to one opinion, that the Malacha of Bona is limited only to karka, or to things which are mechubal karka, structures. It doesn't apply to kelim altogether. The question is, we have to understand what the parameters of that statement is. Is that statement is as sweeping as we think it is? So the Rishonim discussed the Shaila in light of two different Gemaras. One, actually a Mishnah, one a Mishnah Masechah Shabbos, and one a Sugya in Masechah Erevin, where the Gemara seems to say diametrically opposed statements about this very topic. About is there an issue of Bona Bechlal on Kalim? It's the way the Rishonim resolve this apparent contradiction that is going to set into motion much of the discussion that we have in terms of quote-unquote breaking or building when it comes to opening up packages and opening up cans. Do the malachas of Bona and the parallel malach of Sosa, demolishing whatever you can build, presumably you can take apart. So do those malachas even make sense in the context of Kalim or not? So there is a Mishnah at the very end of Masechah Shabbos where the Mishnah says, Shover Adam Masechah Chavis. If a person has a barrel and the barrel is full of fruit, you want to break the chavis in order to get to the fruit. Why don't you just open up the barrel? I don't know. Can't figure out how to open up the barrel. You can't find the key to the barrel. You can't pull the top of the barrel. So it's easy for you just to take the barrel, smash it on the ground, and take out all the fruit. It's probably not a barrel of wine. That would probably be not such a good idea to do it with a barrel of wine. We have a barrel of solid, dry fruit. So you want to throw it onto the ground and take out the fruit. Is that permissible or not? So the Mishnah says, outright mutter. Shoiva adamis chavis. The not a gregoris, you can throw it onto the floor, take out the gregoris, take out the figs, and shine. So why should that be mutter? So Rashi, on the spot, says something very somewhat strange. Rashi says the reason why that's mutter is because it's derech kilkul, and kol makalchon peturin. Anybody who does things in a destructive manner is automatically putter. So here, I'm taking the barrel. The barrel used to be this great functional barrel. I throw it onto the floor, smash it to smithereens. So now it's mokulko, now it's been destroyed. So the reason why it's mutter is because kol hamakalkul peturin. The implication of Rashi is twofold. The implication of Rashi is that there is some kind of an isser here that we have to reckon with. Rashi is not saying it's mutter because it's not a malacha. Rashi is saying it's one of the lametes malachas. We're not sure which one yet. The only reason why it happens to be mutter is because of kol hamakalkul peturin. That's the first implication of Rashi. The second implication of Rashi is that kol hamakalkul peturin doesn't just mean potter, like it usually means. Potter usually in Shabbos means potter of al asur, some kind of an issur d'rabbanan. If Rashi is invoking this Mishnah of kol hamakalkul peturin as being the source for why it's mutter, the Mishnah doesn't say potter, the Mishnah says mutter. The Mishnah tells you what to do. Shoiva adam es achavis. You're allowed to go l'chadchil and take a barrel and smash it on the floor to get out the figs. So if Rashi is invoking the principle of Kol Mekalkel Peturin, then Rashi is in effect telling us that Kol Mekalkel Peturin is much more than just the regular meaning of Potter. Potter means Potter Umutter.
Is the fact that it's figs that's Ochel?
Oh, okay, very good, excellent. Okay, so the question is, what do we do with the second half of Rashi? So what
one more question. Yeah. And also, is the barrel now Muksa, or can you use the pieces of the barrel or something else?
So that's a general muktzah question. So whenever I have any kli that breaks on Shabbos, so then the Gemara says it depends. If the pieces of the kli are still usable for something, then it's all right. Then it's called shivrei kelim or ruyim l'malacha. Shivrei kelim or l'malacha are not considered to be muktzah. If it's shivrei kelim she'enem ruyim l'malacha, I can't do anything with it. So then it's mamash like junk. That becomes like eitz and the avanim, just sticks and stones, and that becomes a real muktzah.
So isn't that counterintuitive? Because if it should be the reverse, Because if it has some type of value, then you want to mekalkel the kli, and it now has a different value. It's a value, a different value. So really, then you shouldn't be able to use the contents. Because you took one use, you created another use.
Okay, so the original sugya of Shibre Kelim is not talking about that I necessarily did. Shibre Kelim means the kli broke by itself. So it's really two sugyas here that we're putting together. So we're talking about from the malacha vantage point, am I allowed to break this kli? Not allowed to break this kli. The Gemara quotes a brice that says, if a kli broke, if it's ru'il malacha, then it's okay. If it's not ru'il malacha, then it's not okay. Sometimes you can have a kli that breaks, and part of the kli is ru'il malacha, and part of it is not. So the part that's ru'il malacha is not muktzah. But it's not ru'il malacha, it is muktzah. It's a classic example. You have a plastic fork. Stick my plastic fork into my piece of chicken, and boom. And now we only have three teeth left of the fork. One breaks off. So is the fork still usable? Yeah, you can still eat with a fork with three teeth to it. So the fork itself you can continue to use. But that one piece that fell off, what do you do with that? That's ain't ru'il malacha. What could you possibly do with a one and a half broken piece of a fork? So then that would be a problem. Let's say you have the shayla a lot. Say you have glasses or something. So your thing falls off your glasses. The glasses, theoretically, they can wear it a little in a clumsy way, even without a second thing against your ear. So then technically, the rest of the glasses is not muktzah. That one thing that fell off, what do you do with that? What could you possibly do with that on Shabbos? So that piece is considered to be muktzah. So that's already more of a muktzah issue. But going back to the malacha part, so then the Rashi says the reason why it's muktzah is because of kilkul. So Rashi, again, has two chiddushim. Rashi's chiddush number one is, there's some kind of an issue here, which we don't know. We're not sure yet which of the lamatas malachas Rashi is referring to that is being overcome by Derek Kilkul, and we're not quite sure why Derek Kilkul overcomes the problem. But the second half of Rashi, the second Chiddush of Rashi, that Derek Kilkul is a matir, so that seems very strange, because that doesn't seem to fit into the text of Chazal, Kol Mekalkel Peturin, and the Gemara tells us that Kol Peturin Shabbos Potter V'Losser. Every time Chazal used the phrase Potter in Hilchos Shabbos, hundreds of times the Mishnah says Potter, Potter, Potter. So the Gemara says every one of those potters is always potter of al asur, with the exception of three. The Gemara singles out three cases. One should take a case in Seder, one should take a case here. Three cases which are potter umutter. Unfortunately, this is not one of them. Kol Mekalkel Peturin is not one of the big three, which leads us to believe that it doesn't sound very well for Rashi. It doesn't sound very good for Rashi, because it sounds from the Lashon of Chazal that Derech Kilkul is still prohibited midirabbanan. Unless one wants to say, like Henry's beginning to say, that maybe Rashi meant to say, not that Kilkul is totally mutter. Nobody would say that just to do a malacha der Kilkul, everything's okay. You can erase der Kilkul, you can break things, everything is mutter der Kilkul. No, kol mekalkel is patur, it's potter v'loser. Rashi meant there's a mitigating factor here. What's the mitigating factor? I need the food. It's Torah Shabbos, Torah Shabbos. So maybe what the Rashi says is what the Ran interprets Rashi to mean. Not that kol mekalkel peturin mutarin all the time, but kol mekalkel peturin. Therefore, min haTorah, there's no problem at all. Now, the worst there is a problem with the Rabbanan. To solve that problem, the Rabbanan, that's where Rashi comes and says, well, by the way, it's only the Rabbanan anyway, and makom mitzvah, tzarech Shabbos, tzarech Shabbos, etc., we're going to lift that issue of the Rabbanan. That wouldn't be a great surprise, because we know there are certain issues of the Rabbanan that weren't lifted for tzarech mitzvah, so again, it's case by case. Tosfos writes in the Sefer Shabbos that Ein Ladamos Yisurim Derabbanan Zelazeh. It's very hard to know how to compare Yisurim Derabbanan. Some Yisurim Derabbanan were lifted under certain extenuating circumstances, and others were not. So this would be one of those examples. So that's a Rashi lives pshat in the Mishnah. But again, in a sense, the more important part for us, sugya, is that Rashi was implying that there was some kind of a problem here that had to be overcome. And if not for the fact that it's Derech Kilkul, we would have been faced with a real bona fide malach, even a malach deraisa. Which of the Lamates Malachas could we have even dreamt that this would be a violation of? You go down the list. Zareah, Chorish, Kotzeb, doesn't sound like any of them. The only one that it could even begin to sound like is Soser. I take a barrel and I break it. That smacks a little bit of Malachas Soser. So that raises the question, because that would seem to indicate that there is some kind of a Malacha of Soser taking place. Again, it happens to be Derech Kilkul, so, and it's Kilkul Tzach Shabbos, so at the end of the day, we're going to give you a green light. But if not for those technicalities, it sounds like we are theoretically dealing with a Malacha, Pashas, the Malacha of Soser, which would lead us to believe that there is some kind of an Isra of Soser and the parallel Malacha of Bona, even though we're dealing with Kalim. But notwithstanding she is Rashi, most of the Rishonim do not accept Rashi. Most of the Rishonim rejected Rashi because They didn't think there was any such klal, kol makachlim peturin, being mutter. They didn't think there was any such klal, that we don't find anywhere in Shas that they lifted this istan, their abundant of kilkul, l'tzarech mitzvah, l'tzarech onik Shabbos. So most of the Rishonim understood the Mishnah literally, mamash kipshuto, shova adam esachoves, not that it's theoretically usur, but we're solving the problem in a Torah, and then we're solving the problem in Torah, but like Rashi, 15 steps. Most of the Rishonim learned kipshuto. You know why it's mutter? It's mutter because it's mutter. Everything's mutter to prove an asar. Why is it mutter? Because there's no malacha being involved. What do you mean there's no malacha? Isn't there selsa? No, there's no selsa because ain't steer b'kalim. So the simple reading of this Mishnah is that the Mishnah is saying straight out, there's no malacha selsa b'kalim. Finish. And if there's no selsa b'kalim, then there's no burning b'kalim either. That's the pashas in this Mishnah. Problem is, there is another Gemara that appears in the third parak of Maseches Erevin that seems to contradict this principle. The Mishnah is talking about somewhat of a technical question relating to Erevin. There is a halacha that if a person wants to make an Erev Tchumen, wants to walk a little bit more than 2,000 amos, so he has to move his house. He has to literally move in. He wants to walk 3,000 amos in Shabbos, so he has to move in at 1,999 amos away from where he really is, and that should become his new house. And then he has 2,000 more amos in that direction. Every time you make an Erev Tchumen, so you gain 2,000 amos in the direction from where you're making it. Of course, you lose it in the other direction because you basically shifted your place. That's what's called to be Kona Shvisa. Every person is Kona Shvisa when Shabbos begins, so we're all Kona Shvisa. So 99.9% of the time, it doesn't make the slightest difference for us because we're all in the big, big city of Teaneck and Bergenfield. It's all one big, big, big city. The houses all continue one from another, even if the zip code changes, and even if they stop plowing the snow at a certain point, but it's still considered to be one city. Well, the houses are continuous, and therefore we're all kind of shvisa in this area. And our tchumen only begin 2,000 amos after this area ends. Where does this area end? Well, it's quite possible that Teaneck just kind of rolls into the next town, into Tenafly, maybe in Englewood, and maybe to Fort Lee, depending on how the houses are all set up. So we may have one giant place. But lu yitzu that we lived in a small village, a small area, we're out in a bungalow colony or something, in the middle of nowhere, so then we would be kona shvisa in the area that we are, and the end of the bungalows, or the end of the houses, would be the end of our kid in shvisa, and then we would start to count off 2,000 amas from that point. So every person is kona shvisa, and they have 2,000 amas in all directions. If a person wants to change the breakdown of 2,000 amas, then they have to make an erev tchumen. So you have to literally move in to the area before Shabbos where you want to be kind of shvisa. How do you move into that area? So the Mishnah tells us that Chazal gave us a break. You don't have to mamish take your whole house and your whole family and set up shop at 1,999 amos. What you can do is you can take some food, symbolically, take some food. A person's food is where his house really is. You take some food, a certain amount of food, and you put it at that spot, and you say, this is my new house. This is my new area. This is where I'm going to shvisa. And now you start the 2,000 amos from that point in all directions. Again, you have to be careful because now you lose in the opposite direction. So that's the din of Erev Tchumen. So the Mishnah tells us that when you make an Erev Tchumen, you have to be careful that the Erev Tchumen, that the food that you set aside is accessible when Shabbos begins. Because the whole idea of the Erev Tchumen is that this is my new house. This is where I'm living. This is where my food. This is where my Shabbos meal is. If for whatever reason, technical or halachic reasons, you can't get to that food, it's impossible for you to eat that food at the time when Shabbos starts. So then the whole Erev is null and void. So that's what the Gemara uses the phrase, "Hu b'makom echad ve'iruva b'makom acher." If I'm in one place and my Erev is somewhere else, and I just logistically, either physically or halachically, just can't get to that Erev, so that's a problem. So that's what the Mishnah begins the following discussion. The Mishnah says, what's the din if a person has an Erev, and he put the Erev 1,999 amos away, he doesn't want to leave it in the middle of the street, leave it in the middle of the forest, an animal will eat it. So the Mishnah says that if the food is not there when Shabbos begins, then the whole Erev is batel mevutel. It doesn't have to be there the whole Shabbos, but it has to be there for Ben HaShemashos, the time the Shabbos starts. So the Gemara in Erevin is a whole lamda shasugya. If a person set up an Erev before Shabbos, and then he realizes afterwards that the Erev was taken away, an animal came and ate the Erev, and he doesn't know whether the animal ate it before Shkia, after Shkia, Suffolk Erev, all the sugyas of Suffolk, Darban Lakula, and Ben Ashmashos, and all complicated sugyas, all revolve around the fact that the Erev wasn't there, or perhaps wasn't there at the critical time. So he doesn't want to get into trouble, so he puts the Erev in a safe place, he puts the Erev in a big box, he locks it up, and he puts this big box, big vault, big safe, and he puts it he puts it right at the mark of 1,099 amas. He's all ready to go. Problem is, the Ovar HaMavtech, he loses the key. So now the guy realizes it's 4 o'clock in the afternoon. He realizes he left this Erev in the right spot, and he's rummaging around. He can't find the key. He has no idea where the key is. So now what? Is the Erev good or is the Erev no good? So the problem is, he can't get to it. Anytime he can't get to the Erev, so that's a problem. Remember, we had there's a parallel halacha in Erev Chatzeres. When you set up an Erev for the whole town, so that's a different Erev. An Erev that permits carrying in a public area, so that Erev has to also be accessible. So let's say if you put an Erev in somebody's house, and the person goes away for Shabbos, and nobody has the key, so then that's the skimar. The same din applies to an Erev Chatzeres. Then the whole Erev is no good. It's for this reason that many communities used to leave the Erev in shul, because they didn't want to leave the Erev, the box of matzahs, for the Erev Chatzeres. They didn't want to leave it in somebody's private home. So the guy goes away for Shabbos, and no one has the key, so we're in trouble. The only problem is that the din is that you're really supposed to leave the Erev in a base diva, in a place where people live. So that's the question. Is a shul considered to be really where a place people live or not? Does that count for the Erev Chatzeres? That's why there's some who didn't like to leave the Erev Chatzeres in shul. In outside of Tinek, so the Erev Chatzeres is not left in the shul. The Erev Chatzeres is in Rabbi Neuberger's house. So you have to make sure that Rabbi Neuberger doesn't go away for Shabbos. And if he goes away for Shabbos, so somebody else has the key. So I think they set up a safety system to make sure that somebody, I don't know, but somebody, if you ask enough people in Beth Abraham, you find someone who has access to get into the house. So therefore, that the Erev is still good. So remember years ago when we had an Erev in the Heights, we had a small, before the Erev, the real Erev that's known today. So it was an Erev literally right down the block connecting two of the apartment buildings. So it used to be kept in somebody's, one of my friend's houses in 480, 187th Street. So he was in charge of the box of boxes, and he went away for Shabbos, and there was a mix-up. Somebody thought they had the key, didn't have the key. Tachas, it was a few minutes before Shabbos, and realized that nobody had the key. So if nobody has the key, it's a problem. So we had to make another Erev Chatzeres. No one had a box of matzahs. You don't need matzahs. You use challahs also. The only reason why we use matzahs is because you don't want to bother making it every week, so the matzahs will last for another year. The challahs will be stale in 2 weeks, and the Erev has to be edible. So but if you just make an Erev for one Shabbos, you can make challahs also. So we scrounged around, grabbed together a couple of challah rolls, and we made it an Erev Chatzeres. But then we wanted to eat the challahs. That's fine. You're allowed, after Ben HaShemashas, you're allowed to eat the challahs. So as long as you can eat it for supper also, as long as you're eating supper, you have to Ben HaShemashas. You eat it for lunch, you have Shal Shittas. There's nothing wrong with eating the Erev Chatzeres. It's just then you would have to make another one next week. Next week, we're going to make sure the guy's home for Shabbos, so we'll have the old box of matzahs back. So that's a din. That's a Mefarish HaDin of a Sex Erevin, that whenever you make an Erev, it has to be Hubim HaMechad, Ve'eruv HaMechad. It has to be Mamsh in the same place. It can't be Hubim HaMechad, Ve'eruv HaMechad. So with the background of this halacha, the Gemara discusses if you have the box of matzahs sitting inside this storage place, inside this migdal, inside this box, inside this closet, whatever it is, and nobody has the key. So the Gemara says that's a problem because hu b'machamecha and v'ru b'machamecha. So you can't leave it the way it is. You have to fix. You have to figure out a way to open this thing up. So come to Rishonim in the spot and they ask, why is that such a terrible problem? What do you mean it's hu b'machamecha and v'ru b'machamecha? Why is that not accessible? Just take this box and smash the box. You never learned the Mishnah in Shabbos. The Mishnah says, Shov Adam Esachavis. The Mishnah says explicitly, you're allowed to take a box, take a barrel, and throw it on the floor, smash it to smithereens, and take out the food. Why? Presumably because there's no Soser. Because it's only a Kli, and there's no Soser in Kalim. So if the Mishnah in Shabbos is true, the Shov Adam Esachavis, you're allowed to break the Kli to get out the food because there's no Soser in Kalim. So why is the Gemara drawing us a two blot of Maseches Erevin to figure out a kunz? How could the Mishnah say that the Erev is good? What happened to it being inaccessible? Why isn't it accessible? So it's very accessible. Just take the box and throw it on the floor. So what's going on in that Gemara? Why does the Gemara in Erevin somehow ignore the whole sugya of Shabbos and Machavis? Why does the Gemara in Erevin assume that there is some kind of a problem? The Gemara seems to be assuming there's a problem of Soyser. And that's contradicted. There's a steer and steerer. There's a steerer in Malacha Soyser. One Mishnah says there's no problem of Soyser and Kalim, and the whole Shakvatar and Erevin is assuming that there is a problem. So there are multiple answers in the Rishonim to this question. So one answer that some Rishonim quote is based on the Rishalmi. The Rishalmi says that the answer to the question is very, very simple. That we read too much halacha, too much lamdos into the Sugya Erevin. We asked the Kasha, Why don't you break the kli gaval? Just take the wooden barrel, take the wooden box, and just throw it on the floor and break it into pieces. So comes Yerushalmi and says, Hacha ba'eskinan b'migdal shel even. That's talking about, it's not wood. You can throw it on the floor from there. Come on, it's not going to break. It's stone. It's not breakable. It's a safe that's just not going to break. So the reason why the Gemara didn't give the eights of breaking it has nothing to do with lamdas. You know, we read the Gemara too much in the eyes of the Beis Medrash. We thought, oh, there must be some halachic problem in breaking this box. But we couldn't figure out what the halachic problem was. There's no halachic problem. There's a physical problem. It's not breakable. If thrown on the floor 100 times, it's not going to break. So according to that, then there's no steer anymore. Now the only sugya that matters, the only sugya that's making a halachic statement is the Mishnah Masechet Shabbos. Yeah, so the truth stands, Shova Adam Asachavis, you're permitted to break a barrel. You don't even have to come with the Rashi that it's because it's Derech Kilkul. The reason why it's Mutter because it was never Asar, because Stira doesn't apply to Kalim. I had the two Bladam Asachas, Erevin, the bending over backwards to figure out how to get your food out for the purposes of Erevin. That's talking about because you don't have an option. There is no way to break. You break, it's not going to work. It's not going to break anyway. So that would take a lot of a sting out of this sugya. The only sugya that really matters is the Mishnah in Masechet Shabbos. But many of the Rishonim don't go down that route. The Gemara, the Bavli, in Masechet Erevin doesn't give us any reason to believe that we're talking about an ukimta. We're talking about a very, very unique kind of a box. The Mishnah's talking about a box, a regular box. Could be wood, could be stone, could be anything. So it doesn't appear from the Bavli to be the case, which of course always opens up the question when you have an explicit statement in the Yerushalmi, and you have a Bavli that's not as clear. So should we just hide behind the Rishami and say, well, yeah, the Bavli meant like the Rishami also, and that's the end of the sugya? Or should we say, no, if the Chachmei Bava really meant like the Rishami, they would have told us, they would have said it, they would have indicated that way, which led, in this particular sugya, many of the Rishami to say, no, there's got to be something else that's going on over here. So what is this something else? So comes the Ran with the following suggestion. Comes around and says, the issue between the sugya and Erevin and the Mishnah Shabbos is really, really touches upon our sugya called Ein Binyan B'Kalim, Ein Steira B'Kalim. However, the Ran says, we have to redefine what exactly is a kli and what is not a kli. Well, it sounds pretty straightforward. This table's a kli, the chair's a kli, the cup's a kli. Anything that moves, by definition, is a kli. The wall, the house, those are considered to be karka. That's considered to be not a kli. Those are mechubla karka. So it sounds pretty straightforward. Whatever could move is a kli. Whatever doesn't move is not a kli. Says the Ran, what would the din be if something could theoretically move, but it's really, really, really big, and most people really wouldn't move it? So is that called a kli, or is that called karka? So that's going to be important now, because ein binyan b'kalim, ein steira b'kalim, but yesh binyan b'karka, yesh steira b'karka. So where does something fit if you have a tremendous, tremendous box that if you get 20 people together, could move it, but an average person wouldn't be able to move it? Is that considered to be halachically like kli, still like a kli, and therefore it's exempt from the malachas of binyan and stira? Or do I say no? Once it becomes an effect not movable, I mean, quote unquote, theoretically not movable, maybe it takes on the characteristics of karka, which in our sugya is going to cause problems. So do we have any precedent in halacha, any other area of halacha, where we find that the halacha differentiates between kalim versus karka, and size plays a role? So there is an area. That's the area of tuma. We know that in Hilchos, tuma is kalim, so a kli is makabel tuma. Karka is not makabel tuma. House is not makabel tuma. The only type of tumah house you get is tumas negoim, neged saras, but that's the yitzim klal. If a dover tumah touches a house, the house doesn't become tumah. I touch the wall, so the wall doesn't become tumah. The kli becomes tumah. The oil doesn't become tumah. The kalim shibasach oil become tumah. So what's the din if I have a type of a kli that's very, very, very big? Is that considered to still be a kli and still subject to tumah? Or does the kli reach a certain size where the din of tumah no longer apply? So the Ran starts searching in Hilchos Tuma to possibly have some impact on Hilchos Shabbos. This is not that far away from an idea we spoke about last week when we spoke about Ohel, what's considered to be an Ohel, how big is an Ohel? So we saw that the Rishonim said, a Tefach. Where did Tefach come from? A So the tefach is rooted in Hilchos Tuma. That the sheer oel in Hilchos Tuma is a tefach. So the Rishonim borrow, the Gemara borrows that idea of a tefach and plugs it into Hilchos Shabbos as well. So sometimes you have to compare halachas. You have to see what are they done. What are the parameters of a halacha in area X, in an area that at first glance seems very, very far away from that topic. Once we define certain klalim of binyan and kli and stira and bona in Hilchos Tuma, maybe you have to shed some light in Hilchos Shabbos. Hopefully, next week we'll try to work on this.
For this particular halacha, when we go to Hilchos Kinyan instead of Hilchos Tumah, because Kinyan would define what the item is, Tumah is defining a different parameter. So you could buy the Inyan of Tefach, we're looking for Shear. Here we're not looking for Shear, we're looking for Metzius.
Okay, this is always a tricky thing. Whenever you start to compare and mix different areas of halacha, you have to really, really understand well which areas of halacha we do turn to, which not. So the Ran is going to turn to Tumah, and many of the Rishonim say that that's not a good model. So next week we'll...